beautiful morning. This is. It's a shame to be indoors, but on the other hand, you don't have an esoteric gathering every weekend in New York City. So, we have a very full day. So, Alvin Holmes is going to speak to us first thing about way back in the 17th century, Celsius, and how different spiritual and esoteric impulses came to America. Richard Geldard is then going to speak to us about Emerson and the whole world of transcendentalism, and I believe link it in with some of the Neoplatonists of Alexandria. Emerson was influenced by the Neoplatonists. Then we're going to have a little play. As I mentioned, it's going to be about a little half-hour reading of a play based upon the life of Margaret Fuller, the editor of the Dial magazine, the one I mentioned briefly last night. Then we're going to have a little chat to talk amongst ourselves, to share our experience in small groups. Then we're going to go for lunch. Then when we come back from lunch, we've got three presentations this afternoon. Ellen Goldberg will be speaking on the Tarot. Dorothea Rockburn will be speaking on her own artwork, her painting, and its relationship to sacred geometry. And our third presentation of the day is, where is our presenter for the third presentation of the day? I know it's here. Let's see, it's Peter, of course, what am I thinking? Yes. The speaker who will be speaking about the esoteric and healing. So then we'll have a half-hour break, and then we'll go over for dinner over at the Persian Grill, which is just across the street. And what should we say? Maybe not everybody is here yet. People are going to trickle in over the next hour. So at the beginning of the next session, I'll ask everybody who wants to go for dinner, because we have to make a reservation upstairs there. Okay, so. Now, so we're going to start with Alvin Holm. I want to say about Alvin that he has been at virtually all of the esoteric gatherings and quests and conferences, and it's been a real pleasure to have him there. So I feel like he's very in tune to the soul. He and his wife Nancy are very in tune to the soul of this. So they've graciously come up from Philadelphia to be with us this weekend. Alvin's been teaching classical architecture since 1981. He's an architect in general practice with projects throughout the United States. He's a founder of the Institute of Classical Architecture. He's taught at the University of Pennsylvania and many other colleges, where we did our conference on an esoteric quest for the mysteries and philosophy of antiquity. Al, along with Steve Bass and the extraordinary Keith Critchlow. Was an amazing gathering of architects attuned to a sacred architecture. Those three had never come together before in a teaching format, and to do it on Sabbath Race was a really wonderful thing. So Alvin has this deep background in classical architecture and sacred architecture, but he's also one of the founding members of the Celsius Society in Pennsylvania, Cal Celsius, who we will hear a lot more about right now. And so he's deeply imbued with the information of how all of this esoteric moss arrived on our shores. And it's lovely to have him here. So let's give a warm welcome for him.
I have three mics. But I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth. And the time that cut both ways and the voice of the woman. It's my wiring, it's not. This is the man, that is Johannes Celsius. He is best described by Whittier in a section of a long poem called The Pennsylvania Pilgrim. He He says, "A painful copyist from his hermit den by Wissahickon, maddest of good men, dreamed o'er the chilliest dreams of Peterson. Deep in the woods where the small rivers slid, snake-like in shade, the helmstop mystic hid, weird as a wizard over arts forbid." And you can see why this guy is very appealing, forbidden arts. "Reading the books of Daniel and of John, and Naaman's morning redness through the stone, wisdom vouchsafed to his eyes alone, whereby he read what man ne'er read before, and saw the visions man shall see no more, till the great angels, striding sea and shore, shall bid all flesh wait on land or ships, the warning trump of the apocalypse, shattering the heavens before the dread eclipse." Well, that's not exactly characteristic of Calpius, but his reputation sort of rumbled out beyond his time. And the darndest stories I told about him, I mean, not that any of them are exactly untrue, but it is a stretch to imagine that he was spotted in Philadelphia and London at the same time, on the same date, in the same year. You know, well, by location, I guess some of you are familiar with that. It's okay. In the neighborhood where the Calpius community used to abide, there are local stories that are spread by kids, by young people to other young people, and then forgotten by as they grow up. So these are it's local legends of subterranean passages and mysterious goings on, all derived from the days of the Calpius community beyond 1700, but are kept alive not in the polite literature, so to speak, or the chronicles, but among the young people who just live in the area for one reason or another, kids to other kids. This is cultural lateral transmission. Very, very interesting. And one of the projects of our Calpius group is to, our current president is a folklorist, and he has embarked in a survey of the impossible stories that are told by kids about this neighborhood, not necessarily about Calpius, but about the cave and many things. So what we are, one of our projects is to chronicle, to record. I hope it doesn't affect the lateral transmission. I hope the kids don't stop telling these stories just because we started writing them down. But it's one of our projects. The music that you are listening to.
Put that in your pocket.
Did we pump that up? I don't think that's distracting as a background. It's music that was written in the community. We're not certain exactly by whom, but presumably kind of a community effort. And it was performed variously. One of the lovely things about the Calpius group was that it welcomed everybody into its activities, shall I say. In ways that the other esoteric groups did not. Calpius was a little critical of the Quakers, for instance, for as lovely as they are, they had their ideas and they were sticking to them. And the Calpius group, as other pietist groups were wont to be, open to everybody's ideas and I was going to say abhorred. They don't abhor anything. Everything is love. But they did not want to be identified as any kind of a cult. They had no prescribed rituals. They had no. They did not want to be identified by any names like Quaker, Shaker, or Mennonite, anything like that. It's characteristic of Pietist groups. One exception being Jane Lee's group in London. And they were called, and they chose to be called, the Philadelphians. And I'll talk to that a little bit. I should tell you...
That's too loud.
Wait, there's trombones coming in.
We can't hear you.
Hear the trombone?
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. One of the instruments that they brought to America was a trombone. So, I was a natural choice in the reconstruction of this music. They also had a virginal, and we're not sure what other kinds of things, some flute-like instruments. Let's give you just a little kind of nuts and bolts. So Calpius came to America as the leader or magister of the Pietist community that Jakob Zimmermann, the original organizer and leader, who had died on the eve of the departure of America. And Calpius, perhaps the youngest of the group and the most perhaps unprepossessing, was selected to lead. I've had the silliest thoughts this morning about talking about Calpius. Based on what we heard last night about Chris's ideas about the foundation that we ought to try to establish. Do you remember a song called Nature Boy?
Yeah.
I think it was from New York. It was Nat King Cole, yeah. Remember?
John Cotton.
There was a boy, a very strange enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far out of the land and sea. And then one day, this is strange how it's talking about, this magic day he came my way. And while we've spoken many things, fools and kings, this he said to me, the finest thing you'll ever know is just to love and be loved in return. Which is the whole story. There was a parody of that song. And it was a kind of a take, it was a boy, a little shy because of his one left eye, but a real wise guy was he. And every time I see this mild little man with this, one squinting eye there, I think of this parody of Nature Boy. But that was really his message. I mean, the entire thing is to see the splendor in all things from the inner eye. And whether you interpret that as the heart or the third eye, which is the seventh of the sixth chakra, which is the Church of Philadelphia in Revelations. Well, that's a stretch. I mean, you don't have to. Each of the seven churches represents one of the chakras leading up to he was born in the Siedenberg region of Transylvania, the area of German Dendorf, in 1673. He was the youngest of three sons of Farrar George Kelt, minister in Holdingen. Reverend Kelt died in 1685, and Johann was sent to Altdorf near Nuremberg to complete a university education. Just a couple of nuts and bolts here. He earned the Doctor of Philosopher degree at the age of 16, with a thesis on Theologiae Naturalis in 1689. His tutor was the renowned Dr. Johannes Fabricius, but he became acquainted with Christian Knorr, Baron von Rosenach, a pietist and hymnist, born in Silesia in 1636, and he studied chemistry, Judaism, Orientalism, and Kabbalah. This next takes us back to the beginnings of this of our many tours, back to the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, the subject of the first escapade of the Open Center in Chesky Krumlov. We talked about the 30 Years' War in the aftermath. German Palatinate at that time was recovering from the devastation of the 30 Years' War with the Peace of Westphalia. Some freedom was granted the major organized religious groups, but the myriad small sects found little tolerance. So when William Penn offered his new land to the dissenters, German immigrants flocked to it, giving Pennsylvania its unique heritage, Mennonite, Amish, Schwenkfelders, Brethren, Moravian, Dunker, and many, many others. The Zimmermann group traveled across Europe, adding to its ranks as it neared London. In London, members met with Jane Lee of the Philadelphia Society, as well as with Henry Diekmann, Alexander Mack, and other mystics. The group chartered the Sarah Maria of Good Hope. Isn't that a lovely name for a ship? The Sarah Maria of Good Hope. And other mystics left Rotterdam in February 1694. Kelpius described the journey in his journal, as did Daniel Faulkner. One of his group was later to become the first Lutheran minister anointed in the New World. He was ordained. Philadelphia is full of many firsts. You'd be so weary of hearing about Philadelphia as first time. But I mean, what can you do? I mean, there was nobody else. So everything was done, was kind of done first. In addition to threats of dangerous weather and boarding by pirates, Kelpius wrote, we also had prayer meetings and sang hymns of praise and joy. Several of us accompanied on instruments that we had bought from London. No real specifications on what, but we know they had a trombone. Kelpius led the group to attractive land, some 175 acres, a parcel of land granted by Thomas Vicarus by William Penn in 1683, and that land is now Fairmount Park. New York thinks of Central Park as being the largest park within the bounds of any American city or something like that, but Philadelphia is bigger. But it's not all within the city limits, it spreads out, so that's it. There are other Philadelphia and New York competitions between them. The Wissahickon group had this irreverently described as a sort of a pickup band. It would play for other organizations, writing departments, they are known to have furnished the music for the dedication of the Gloria Dei Church in 1700, that's Old Swedes, and for the ordination of justice following in 1703. There's Lutheran ordination in the colonies. He was a frail man, and he died of consumption in the age of 35 in 1708. Tired of looking at that guy. This is an early map of Philadelphia. Philadelphia was laid out by a fellow named Holmes at the instruction of William Penn. And this just shows the northwest quadrant. That's the center square where City Hall stands now. And Logan Square. This is Center Square. The Delaware is over here. This is the Schuylkill River. And there was another square there, another square there, another square. Four squares, very symmetrical, north and south, east and west. And it's about 2 miles. It's about a mile from one river to the center and another mile to the next center. City Hall is here. Now this is Logan Square, presently Logan Circle, where we raised a family. And up here was the single promontory in this whole area, and it was called nowadays Fairmount. early map in French. It is called Montagne de Feu, Fire Mount. And it is notable that in 1694, on Midsummer's Eve, Johannes, or about the Feast of St. John, Johannes Gelfius arrived in Philadelphia to establish the community of brethren known as the Woman in the Wilderness. It was known by others as the Woman in the Wilderness. They issued many names of it. It is known as the Woman in the Wilderness in reference to a passage I will quote from the Revelation of St. John. He and his company went straightway to Fairmount, a promontory between the rivers, to light the traditional Midsummer's Night bonfire in celebration of the Feast of St. John. It's interesting that they should arrive on the Feast of St. John and straightway, you know, make it up across the land to this Fairmount. It's suggesting that they knew what was taking place there. Now, a little gloss on this, sort of an informal history, a fable that I confess to having sort of made up, is that before Europeans came, this was a holy hill for the Native Americans. It was dedicated to Mother Earth. And this was a sanctuary. If you were a bad monk, there are informal stories about things that took place, you know, their lovers' leaps and things like that, Native American lore. So we have a hill there dedicated to the earth. When the Europeans came, presumably the Swedish settlers, with their tradition of the big zeal on Midsummer celebrations, they perhaps lit the first bonfire there on Midsummer nights, and other Europeans picked it up. This is a practice that is still going on, I think, in some parts of Europe, where a big bonfire is lit and then it dies down, and they kick the coals, and they run through the coals, and then they push them down. And this is what they participated in the first day they arrived. I mean, they arrived kind of a bang. And then they went over to out to the Wissahickon Valley, the third little river. This is Fairmount now. This is the art museum built on Fairmount. I should say right here that having been a mount dedicated to the earth, it became a mount dedicated to fire, the second element. In the middle of the 19th century, it was hollowed out, literally, the whole hill was hollowed out as a reservoir. Water was pumped from the Schuylkill River up into this hollowed out hill and then fed into the center square and distributed there from a pump house into the four quadrants of Philadelphia. So from earth it came to fire, and from fire it came to water. And then in the 20th century, in the 1920s, this great Greek-style temple was built to the Olympian gods, so to speak, the gods of the air, the heavens. So we completed the cycle from earth to fire to water to air.
Could you say what's the gods of air? How do the gods
have the Olympian
air?
Gods.
Oh,
it's a Greek temple, so it's Olympian gods. Okay. I mean, they had other things in mind as well, and it's not a totally conscious evolution. Except that below the hill there are four entries to the cellars, and over each of those entries there's a Greek word, and I don't remember what they were, for the four elements, with a little symbol. So, you know, I made it up, and then I discovered I was right on track.
Who's the figure? The sculpture, the statue.
Oh, it's George Washington. Didn't you recognize him? Okay, we better get back to the text here. Here's another. This is the view down the Benjamin Franklin Parkway of the Holy Hill. And turning around, we see center square, and that great, I've got to call it a kind of a phallic tower up there, because it corresponds so nicely at the other end with the sort of the embracing shape of the art museum at the other end. I mean, the stand here, look at this gesture, stand there, look at that gesture, and it's unmistakable. I mean, I'm not looking, making, I'm not drawing these pictures. I'm only describing them. There. Here it is at night. This is the art museum, you know, part of the cathedral, at the city hall. You ask, why Philadelphia? How did it happen that they came to Philadelphia? There are many other places they could have gone. Why Philadelphia? And the answer is in the apocalypse. The book of Revelations is written to the seven churches by John, whoever John of Patmos. And the voice came to him saying, I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, and what thou seest, write in a book and send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, unto Pergamos, and unto Thyatira, and unto Sardis, and unto Philadelphia, and unto Laodicea. And then he goes on to sort of talk to each church, scolding them about how they've kind of dropped the ball, they've been unfaithful to one church after another, until he gets to the sixth church, and to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, he says, write this, these times, well, I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it, for thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and thou hast not denied my name. So the church of Philadelphia, which is just a little inboard of Smyrna, today's, what's Smyrna called?
Izmir.
About 30 miles east is the little town which is Philadelphia. It has another name now, but it's the same town. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of temptation which shall come upon all the world, to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold thou fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. It goes on to the seventh church, the Laodiceans, and it's really, they're very important. Laodicean became sort of synonymous with the losers. You know, they just didn't hold faith. But Philadelphia did. So that's one of the reasons that Penn called the city Philadelphia, because he knew that that was the city that was faithful. That's certainly the reason the esoteric group in London called themselves the Philadelphians, because they felt that they were holding the truth, not like all the other groups were holding the truth, but their truth was, in a sense, larger, and in another sense, a smaller. It was far more simple, there was no creed, there was no... The whole idea was that there is an inner and an outer, and they are one. And I don't know that you could say it more succinctly than that. But there is an individuality, but each of us inwardly is also everywhere. It sounds Emersonian in a way. It sounds deeply transcendental. It sounds, and you hear little notes and letters that companies wrote and people in the community, and darn it, it doesn't sound like the rhapsodic gushings of Emerson as he walks through the woods or sees morning come up, on a large scale and a small scale. You know, the little bits of beauty that we see in everything, like the gleaming teeth of a dead dog, you know, or as well as the majesty of the sunrise and the sunset. Valley of the Wissahickon, the community was over here. This is the little Wissahickon that comes into the Schuylkill over here, and the Schuylkill eventually comes into the Delaware down south. Here's a topo map of that's the Henry Avenue Bridge. It's a pretty mighty thing. It's a very moving experience to drive along the Wissahickon River and go underneath this magnificent bridge. Designed incidentally by the same architect who designed the parkway that you saw pictures of a little bit earlier. Oh, well, my slides are kind of jumbled here. But I recognize them anyway. Apart from my notes, we're a little out of sequence, but who isn't, I guess. The interesting thing about driving under the bridge, no matter how you feel in the morning on your way to work, once you drive under this bridge, you feel better. And it's the same thing after a hard day's work. And yet my wife had a bakery out in where's your bakery anyway? But, and you and a young Mexican woman used to drive out, and no matter how grumpy they were in the morning, as they passed under, they felt better. Coming home is the same thing. This is a life-enhancing experience to drive under this bridge. Years later, I understood why, because there is a ray line, there is a real zap of energy. It's a earth energy, telluric force, that runs parallel to the bridge, zing right across here, and intersects the Kelpius community, which I was trying to show you a picture of the site plan. Coming down a steep hill on a little path, we pass a spring that is alleged to have been doused by Kelpius or one of his group. These guys were called the Hermits of the Ridge, but they were not hermits at all. They lived together in a kind of a communal way, but they were very much in the world. They performed all kinds of services, as I say, music, dousing. Kelpius was a lawyer, he had official positions in the community. I mean, they were outgoing while remaining inward. That's the trick. So, dousing. This is the principal shrine to Johannes Kelpius. This is the cave where he's alleged to have meditated. Part of his bad health may have been attributed to living in this dank little cavern. But we don't think that's true. It was definitely part of the community, but it's more likely that it was a root cellar and certainly not a ritual space, although it could have been used for meditation. Improved over the years and sustained and honored by a stele here saying, Johannes Kelpius, PhD, dying in 1708, the contented of the God-loving soul, magister of the first Rosicrucian Amlock colony in America, which arrived in Philadelphia. And this is put here by the Supreme Grand Lodge, Amlock. Everybody know Amlock, ancient mystical order of the Rosicrucians. That's the largest Rosicrucian organization in America. There are three others notably as of 15 years ago or so, there was a schism in Amwork, and a group called OMSI split off. Ordo, Militia, Crucifera, Evangelica, of which I am a Christian member. So that's Nancy, my wife, meditating, dousing in the cave. That's a pendulum between her legs there. And allegorical pictures. That certainly the symbolism of a cave has got to be interpreted as the inner experience as well. I mean, whether the cave specifically that, you know, refers to the heart or the chambers of the heart or the head. Sometimes the cave is depicted as kind of a skull, but it's definitely the inward experience that is noted in all these allegories of the cave. So it's not surprising that the cave here has been chosen to represent the community. This is looking out from the cave. I should read you another little thing from Revelations here. Why were they called the woman in the wilderness? They didn't dislike the name, but they eschewed any naming. And so there was other people that called them. But they came to America, as many other groups had come, because it was regarded as the wilderness. You know, there was old Europe, and then there was the new world, where the new heaven and earth would begin. And the woman in the wilderness is in chapter 12 of the book of Revelations. It says, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet. And upon her head, a crown of 12 stars." This is not exactly that, but it's so similar. And she, being with child, you seem to, you probably can't identify that, but that is a child in the womb, a child of the sun and the moon and the mother, the woman. She cried, travailing in birth and pained to be delivered. And when she brought forth a man, child, from sitting there, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Well, this number has been worked over and over and over, and we keep anticipating this to be the end of the world, but it hasn't come yet. Maybe we could rejigger the numbers anyway. And a little later on it says, "And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and a half a time from the face of the serpent." There's just much to be talked about here, but suffice it to say that a primary allegorical image for all the groups that came here was this flight of the woman to the wilderness, where the new heaven and earth, where the new Savior and the new heaven and earth would begin. More cave imagery here, heart imagery, crown imagery, two eyes, you know, all kinds of things, full of alchemical this and that. I should get on with what the man was all about here. And he wrote one notable book that is intact, and it's called A Method of Prayer. It's been it was written in German and translated, we think, first by Dr. Christopher Witt, who came over a little bit later and joined the community. And Witt sort of carried on after Celsius died and went as a practicing doctor. It was the first college practicing doctor, the first doctor who taught other doctors and kind of ordained young physicians. And grew apparently a great deal of money for the establishment of the first hospital in the New World, which is Pennsylvania Hospital. He wrote this brief book, to explain his understanding of Paul's admonition or suggestion that we pray without ceasing. And a lot of people have, you know, fussed with this. Well, how do you pray without ceasing, you know, without... Because the pietists felt that they should live in the world, but not be entirely of the world. So, I mean, you can't, if you're going to be a, you know, butcher, baker, a cobbler or something, an architect, trombonist, I mean, you can't just pray continuously and muttering, although some groups think it's okay. They were very uncritical of everybody else, so I'm putting things on the issue. But they felt that there must be a way, I mean, Paul wrote it down in Corinthians, I guess, there must be a way to sustain this prayer. And this is a little excerpt from it. There is a prayer which may be performed at all times and in all places, which by nothing can be interrupted, but by sin and unfaithfulness. I interpret unfaithfulness to mean forgetfulness. You know, I mean, just not caring, you know, backsliding, so to speak. But because that the faith business is emphasized in the Revelations. I mean, that's what the Philadelphians were able to sustain, is the faith, and so they didn't forget. The soul, having thus presented herself before God, he instructs her in the way of his commandments, for God takes delight in instructing the soul as soon as the soul is attentive. This should be effortless. You know, just tune in, you know, and it'll come. The prayer of the heart may be performed at all times, though the heart cannot think or speak at all times. This way is called a mystical way. These guys are not the first to understand that there is this way, right? Inward prayer is the nourishment of the soul. It is in this holy rest that the soul obtains the strength which is so needful for her. Take this nutriment from her, and she will presently be disheartened. Yes, oftentimes fall into deadly dejection. You know, loving, disheartened. Heart kind of taken out. The prayer of divine love, which consists in the entire, this is the key to my mind. I mean, in my mind, this is the key. The prayer of divine love, which consists in the entire inclination of the heart towards the supreme good, which is God, can be as little or rather less interrupted, since the heart is never weary of loving. So I'm interpreting this as a posture, kind of as an attitude, you know, psychological attitude in kind of physical terms. If the heart is the vessel of the soul, the heart is the vessel of whereby love is poured out. As you pour it, if you incline it, love is poured out in order that love be refilled in the vessel. So it's this continuing posture. I mean, whatever you're up to, wherever you're doing, with practice, then this can be developed. And as you see, it's a psychological attitude as well as a description of a kind of a physical image of the cup being ever full, as long as you keep emptying it. A whole lot more. Lots more pictures. You'll be happy to hear, I guess, that the community continues in one way or another for a while. I'll tell you, the first time I went down to the Glen, the Hermit's Glen, A lot of sort of landmarks are related to the community. There's Hermit's Lane, there's Hermit Glen, the Hermitage is a place. I was walking in the woods. I don't remember exactly what my ambition was that day, but it was on a Saturday, I guess, and I guess it was the eve of the Feast of St. John, and I heard a murmuring below me as I came down this long little path, and I heard deep voices going, rom, rom, and I heard more feminine voices going, mom, mom. That's maybe not quite the interval, but there was this long chant going with lighter voices going mom and other voices going rom. I don't know that this rings bells for any of you, but it was very beautiful to hear, very eerie, a very weird thing. I thought for a while I was having a vision, an oral. But in fact, they were really there, and there was a bunch of people down there. That's not this picture, but there, a group of Rosicrucians from the, I guess it was the Benjamin Franklin Lodge in North Philadelphia, the Rosicrucians, Mark. And they gather there every St. John's Eve to commemorate the Kelpies, the coming of Rosicrucianism to America. We try to carry on the Kelpie Society. The Lodge has gone in slightly other directions. Lots of the original members of the AMORC are now members of the OMC, Order Militia Cruciferi Evangelica. So there's a little schism there. The Kelpies community tries to get its group together and do programs here. And this is one of them. That's another one. There's the younger architect holding forth about something or other. This is a very handsome house called the Hermitage. It's clearly the 19th century house. It is suggested that it's built on the a Victorian mansion belonging to Fairmont Park, built by Evan Prowatin, a Russian noble from the years 1848 and 1849. Tradition holds that it stands on the foundations of the Kelpies Tabernacle. The tabernacle is described as a kind of a cube of a building 40 feet by 40 feet by 40 feet high. Great cube of a building. That's a big building in those days. Our research suggested, however, another site for the tabernacle where the Henry Avenue Bridge now crosses the Wissahickon. There's a high rocky promontory where we believe the tabernacle was sited and the first fixed astronomical telescope was placed. It's another Philadelphia first. They brought with them an enormous telescope. In those days, the astrology that they practiced had less to do with the magnification of canals on Mars, you know, and more precise measurements of the movement of the bodies, the planets, and you know. So it was that they were measuring. Now this took a very stable foundation in the first place, and the rocks in this area are known to be among the geologically most stable parts of the United States. I mean, far more stable, say, than the Rocky Mountains or something, because these are older, they've been worn down, and they're very, very still. So it's a good place to put a big telescope. Big telescopes had huge timber beams that were fixed in a very solid way so that the tiny movements of the stars could be calculated with great precision. There in 1703, 7 years after their arrival, and again on June 23rd, the Feast of St. John, another bonfire is lighted, and it is written, the glowing apparition of the Virgin, or the woman in the wilderness, appeared three times above the tabernacle. We don't think this was the tabernacle itself. That's that's the, there's a novel in the foreground, alas, is the site of what we believe was the original residence of Johannes Kelpius himself. The ruins we see were here were called Lauriston Cottage, a small building showing renovations of at least five historic periods. It was demolished by Fairmount Park in 1983 because it was in hazardous condition. Beneath the stucco walls, it was found to conceal a log cabin structure, which is certainly the earliest such a structure in the Philadelphia area. What a pity, had they known, you know, they wouldn't have torn it down. And we tried to stop them because we knew, and the bulldozers just came. But we were able to mount a little rescue survey group, and we've got pretty good pictures and measurements of the place. There was reason to believe that the foundations for this building is part of the actual dwelling of Johannes Kelpius, and again, archaeology is expected to verify this point. Currently, we have an archaeological dig sponsored by the University of Pennsylvania. A student is working on a dissertation, I guess, and he's got state archaeologists sort of looking over his shoulder. We're very excited about that. This is Lauriston Cottage. These are terraces. We believe there was an orchard here in the Kelpius days. Here you see it in its decrepitude. Here you see it. This was the demolition originally began with young people apparently having parties in there. And at one point they pushed the bathtub through the wall and onto the end. So, I mean, golly. And that's what's why Fairmount Park, I think it was an attractive nuisance, decided to tear it down. Mm-hmm. Here it is, you see, you can't see very well, but you see the original log cabin. This is a lighter addition. There's another addition over there. And this is the condition that was in when we were doing the survey. Douglas, the architect, Palsy, as the hermit in this. Here's a couple of drawings. That's what it looks like today. And there's another whole lecture we could do on the one artifact that remains from this community, which is called the sundial akaz, or the orologium. And it's very beautiful, and it's in the possession of the historical, the Philosophical Society of Pennsylvania. And I'm glad it's the end of my time, because I couldn't begin to explain how this works, except that there's a picture up here on the top of Ahaz, written about it in Ezekiel, I guess, Isaiah, who's pleading for his life, and I don't know what the situation was, but God causes the sun to stand still for a while the medications are applied to his leg and his lips, and then the sun goes on and moves. But for this the story of this orologium illustrates the time standing still and actually moving backwards and then moving forwards again. And here we go. That's
it. Goodbye. Well, that's very unusual. Very unusual to get a glimpse of those very first moments of esoteric spiritual life in America. So it's rare that we have somebody from the Kelpius Society right here amongst us. But we got off to a late start because of the technical problems. So we'll take a break after the next presentation.